If you've seen movies like Spellbound, you know the National Spelling Bee can be quite intense.
I'm really nervous. My hands shake when I get the computer. It's really a lot of anxiety for the competition.
That's 8th grader Asta Patel from Champaign. We'll hear from her and other competing spellers from Illinois. Speaking of documentaries, there's a new one out about the Chinese Exclusion Act, which will be shown on PBS tonight. We'll speak with the filmmakers. But first,
Ben was really smart, and I think he was used to being able to figure out his way out of a problem. And I think that this wasn't a problem that he could see his way out of, except for this.
That's Beth Martinez speaking to Illinois Newsroom reporter Madeline Beck about her brother, Benjamin Bloom of Germantown, who died after committing suicide. He's part of a group with the highest suicide risk, older men in rural areas with guns. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and happy Memorial Day. Think about what's in your basement or your attic. Is that where you tossed your dad's old baseball collection or your old baby quilt? What about grandma's old black and white photos? Are they sitting in a shoebox covered in dust? We've all done it. For lack of time or a better place, we put some of our most precious family treasures in places that might not be the best when it comes to safekeeping. But lucky for us, every year, the U of I Spurlock Museum and University Library put on a preservation emporium. They assemble experts in various subjects like textiles, books, musical instruments, even archaeology, who can tell you all about the preservation, treatment, and storage of your heirlooms and artifacts. Although this year's emporium was back in April, it's never a bad time to learn how to keep those precious family heirlooms intact. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with Krista D.C. Quinn, the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum, and Jennifer Hain-Tepper, the preservation librarian at the University Library. They joined me in our Urbana studios back in April. I started by asking Krista what it's like now that the Preservation Emporium is 10 years old.
Well, it's been really exciting. When Jennifer and I started this in, 2007, Jennifer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't know how many people would show up, but we have had over 130 show up to one of our events, and it's really exciting to have people come in, bring their family treasures. We get to have a lot of storytelling, talk about pieces that people want to take care of. It's been a really fun event for both the participants and those experts who come and advise.
Jennifer, have there been any unique items that people have brought in?
Well, they're always unique items. That's kind of the beauty of the event, is that every year different things come. I mean, there are some standard family Bibles and whatnot and quilts that we see every year, but there have been some really fascinating pieces that have come in. I think my personal favorite is one that Krista and I actually co-collaborated on, which was an artillery box from the Civil War that originally went over to Krista because Krista typically advises on textiles but is also kind of our de facto objects specialist, being a collections manager at the museum. But because it was bound in leather or wrapped in leather and leather books are my specialty, we kind of co-collaborated on that one. But the fact that of all the things that were kept, it was an artillery box.
Yeah.
It was just kind of strange, but it was in excellent condition. It was just fascinating to hear the story of how it got passed down and whatnot. And I think that was one of the most unique things that we've seen.
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely amazing.
So, Jennifer, you mentioned your area of expertise. That's books and paper. Is that correct?
That is correct. And photographs.
And so when it comes to books, papers, photographs, what do you think the most common mistake is that most people are making when they're in terms of preservation?
Storage. I think that's going to be universal for almost all of us, except maybe the archaeology people, because stone is really easy.
Well, that and also it's in the ground, then it's not.
Right. But for paper materials in particular, one of the biggest concerns is storage temperature and relative humidity and light exposure. And of course, a lot of these heirlooms, as you noted in the introduction, get squirreled away in the basement or the attic where the environment is terrible. And unfortunately, that really speeds up deterioration, particularly with photographs. But there are lots of other issues with pests and whatnot in storage as well. So it's finding a good storage environment for your materials. That's really the most important part and the most common mistake.
And what is a good storage environment? Does climate matter? I'm thinking about maybe how cold it might get or how hot it might get in an attic. Does that make a difference?
There's kind of a divine trilogy in preservation called cool, dark, and dry. And Krista and I will say this over and over and over again, is that you want to keep things cool. You definitely want to keep them in the dark, and you want to keep them from getting too humid because you want to avoid the risk of mold or insects or anything like that.
Generally, where you stay in your house is where you want to preserve your items. So you generally don't live in an attic unless it's finished, or in your basement unless it's finished and has a good temperature and relative humidity. So generally the main living floors are usually where that's the best preservation as well.
Right. So we recommend that people look at interior closets are usually the most stable place that is a good kind of out of the way storage area, but also a good environment for family heirlooms.
And we also advise on how to display items in your home if you want to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, before we get to that, Krista, can you tell us about your area of specialization?
Well, I deal with objects. So our museum has all sorts of things from going back about 250,000 years, which I don't think most families will have all the way up until modern age. But in this particular area, I mainly talk about textiles, so quilts, christening gowns. I've had samplers come in.
When it comes to old textiles, so I'm thinking particular of things like a family quilt, what are we doing wrong, or what are the most common mistakes you see?
People like to throw everything in the washer. That's usually the most common mistake. If something is coming apart, they want to wash it. And usually your washer can ruin things pretty quickly, especially if you have silks and some other things. And detergents can be pretty harsh on things.
And so should things be hand washed? Should you take them to professional dry cleaners? Should you not wash it?
Pretty much we're cringing. It's you can't see.
You can't touch it.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, you want to maybe bring it to a conservator in that case. You know, it depends on the type of materials it's out of. Sometimes these things come out of homes that have been a lot of smoking. You know, so you just want to be really careful in looking at that. And so sometimes, especially with crazy quilts, they're built of many different types of material. So sometimes the material actually affects each other. So, you know, I ask, can you hang it over on one of those quilt display racks? Can you put it in a guest room that's not really stepped on by pets and that kind of thing? And, you know, so it's mainly looking at that type of thing.
So if it somehow gets stained, you just kind of have to make your peace with it.
Well, yeah, I say the stains are part of the story in that case. So, I mean, unless you're actively using it, a lot of times that is part of its story.
Oh, okay, because sometimes maybe people see there's an old stain, you don't even know where it comes from, and you're trying to clean it because you think it's icy.
And so a lot of people just want things clean, and I don't blame them for that. So we talk about vacuuming things. I can explain that. But, like, right. As soon as you add water or detergent to anything,
What people don't realize, and that Krista and I deal with on a fairly regular basis, is the fact that, of course, we all as humans live with water. It's part of life. Mm-hmm. But chemically, water is really reactive. And the action of washing is actually a very, very aggressive process. And so for most of the materials that we deal with in cultural heritage, introduction of water is actually a very scary and potentially dangerous thing. So while washing, you know, your blue jeans seems perfectly okay, washing a fragile old quilt or an old silk flapper dress with a bunch of glass beads or something like that can actually cause more damage than it causes good.
Krista, I'm thinking about, well, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that, you know, it's also, you know, dry cleaning as well. You have to be really careful.
Krista, I wanted to ask you from the cleaning standpoint, maybe with quilts, one thing is maybe it might not be dirty, but it might get really dusty. Did you say something about vacuuming?
Yeah, you can totally vacuum them. So, you know, you basically will take a, you know, brush and, you know, you kind of lightly vacuum if it's not going to, you know, get sucked up into it. I will have a demonstration vacuum there. And so you can kind of carefully vacuum it if there's not a lot of loose pieces. But if we're talking about the flapper dress with all the beads, you don't want to add a vacuum to it. So instead we brush it off. So we have, like, you know, like brushes, and we'll have some of those there at the Emporium.
And one handy little trick that we use when we vacuum books, because we vacuum books too, but that works with textiles, is if you're not certain how fragile it is, you can actually put a piece of pantyhose over the top of the vacuum so that if, God forbid, anything does get sucked up, it gets trapped by the little screen there and doesn't get sucked into the
vacuum.
There
is nothing worse than having to fish through the vacuum for the thing that got sucked into the vacuum. Yeah. You learn that very fast in our field.
Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum. Jennifer Hain Tepper is the preservation librarian at the University Library. I wanted to ask, and either of you jump in here, about going back to the idea of quilts or tapestry. I think there's a kind of always two camps of people who think you have something beautiful, you should just use it or you should display it. What are your thoughts about someone who wants to be able to look at maybe a tapestry or a quilt rather than store it safely?
Well, I think that and this goes for books or photographs as well. You want to make sure that if you're going to put them in your home, not in direct sunlight, not in a kitchen because of the grease, you know, that can lodge onto it, not near an open vent and not near a fireplace. So you can display things with those parameters and it'll last longer. Now you can always put it, it's the person who belongs to it, it's their item. So.
Right. I mean, that's generally what I recommend to people is you have to, if you, The reason you're keeping this is because you appreciate it. And if you want to see it, that is part of the reason that you're keeping it. There are ways to be strategic and smart about display to make sure that you're not intentionally damaging the object. But use and exposure will increase the deterioration as opposed to putting it in dark storage in a closet. But then what's the point?
Right.
I mean, I have family china that, you know, periodically I break. And I'm like, well, you know, but it's being used and it's being appreciated. And that's the point of having it, is enjoying it. So we can recommend safe ways to display. Interior walls is another one, as opposed to exterior walls, because there's less temperature and humidity variation. But generally what Krista was saying is it goes for almost any family heirloom, is just be sensible about how you're displaying it, and that will really help.
And also recording the story of it. So quite frequently, if we recommend people frame it, that you actually tape on the back of it like an envelope, or you have something with the family story, because we hear these amazing stories.
Right.
And often that's not always translated down to the different generations, and that information is so valuable. That story is part, also needs to be preserved.
Right.
How do you suggest that story gets preserved?
Well, I usually do it eye legible, meaning on, like, if you're framing
on
something
paper.
On paper on the back. And so that way it travels with the piece all the time. I mean, you can also, you know, have it digitally, but, you know, this way when you inherit, like, your, you know, picture on the back, you're like, you see this envelope, and then you pull it open, and then you see these old letters, or you see whatever is corresponds with that story.
My grandfather, who was anal retentive and a photographer, actually went through and wrote little notes on every family heirloom and either put them with a piece of string or stapled them up under the furniture or whatever.
That's
and it's
awesome.
It's been invaluable to have the history of. We have a table that goes back to the pre-Revolutionary War period, and he has the whole lineage of how the table passed through the family. And if he hadn't written that down, I wouldn't know it.
And now you're preserving that information, because the information or the family story is just as important as the object itself.
Absolutely.
Krista, something I've always worried about, wondered about, is wedding dresses.
Right.
I actually just got back from a wedding, and people spend a lot of money storing dresses for future generations. Do you have to spend a lot of money on this? And what happens to them years later? Because I just feel like you don't necessarily see lots of brides wearing old dresses.
I know, right? And so I think that you do need to spend money on cleaning the dress, you know, because if you want someone to wear it again, you go to a reputable dry cleaner or, you know, a type of cleaner to do that. Unless it's an antique gown, then you do something different. But generally, they'll have boxes and things like that that you put it in. Again, the same thing. Jennifer, you want to say it. Cool.
Cool, dark, and dry.
Yep. And you don't want to store it in your attic or your basement, interior closet, and box it away. Also, have a story of when this gown was used and maybe a picture. Like an actual picture of the wedding of the bride in the gown. And so that's also part of its story as well.
Yeah, so I like the idea of you all wanting, obviously it makes a lot of sense to record the story along with it. I want to ask you about wedding dresses, but one more thing that I think people like to collect, which is stamps. Jennifer, if you are an amateur stamp lover, or maybe you want to start doing this, if you see something, a cool one that maybe comes through the mail, what's the next best step?
Well, I gotta say, I'm one of the people who is much maligned by the move to pressure-sensitive stamps, because that's made my life a whole lot harder. Back in the day when we had stamps that you actually had to lick, those were a whole lot easier to preserve, because unfortunately the adhesive that they use for pressure-sensitive stamps is much less chemically stable. And
so like self-stick stamps is
self-stick,
what you're
saying.
Like
right, the sticker stamps
okay.
that are what you get nowadays, unless you specifically seek out licky-sticky stamps.
Well, they tasted awful, the licky-stickies. I know, but all right.
Anyway. Nonetheless, the adhesive was a lot more stable on the licky stamps than it is on the self-stick stamps. So regardless, with modern stamps, assuming that most of them now, unfortunately, are pressure sensitive, in most cases, what you want to do is try to cut it off the envelope. Don't try to steam it off. Don't try to lift it off. It's going to cause a lot of damage to the stamp. So, you know, ideally, a lot of people actually like to keep the postmark, keep the entire envelope. That's a whole lot easier than trying to remove the stamps and put them into some sort of book where it's just the stamp. So that's one key thing. And then honestly, they're just, again, they're paper storage. So getting a good quality album or folder or something to store them in to make sure that they're in a good storage environment. So putting them into like plastic sleeves, generally speaking, isn't great, but good quality paper storage is really advantageous, especially if you don't know.
And we're giving some of those away.
And we have a raffle, and we're giving away good quality storage materials our raffle.
Last question. We have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you quickly, what about someone who thinks they have something that's valuable? What should they do? What would you suggest?
They are welcome to give us a call. We will have, you know, on the website all the, you know, different departments. So I do, we do answer calls mm-hmm. at times over the phone and that kind of thing.
Right. But in our jobs at the university, we can't provide any sort of appraisal purposes
no.
or anything like that. So we can direct them to the American Association of Appraisers, who are
yeah.
trained to be able to do this. We can look at things and say, wow, that looks really interesting.
Yes.
But we can't say whether it's valuable or not.
Yeah, I thought value as in preservation, because that's always how I think about it, right?
And I was thinking Antiques Roadshow.
No, yeah. we don't do that.
We don't do that.
I want to thank Spurlock Collections Manager Krista D.C. Quinn and University Preservation Librarian Jennifer Hain Tepper for being with us here on the 21st. Thanks for being with me, ladies.
Thanks so much for having us.
My pleasure.
When you think of home to barbecue, what states come to mind? Texas or Missouri, maybe, but not perhaps our home state. After the break, we're going to be talking to local barbecue junkies about some of the best spots to grab great barbecue here in Illinois. That's coming up on this special Memorial Day Encore presentation of the 21st. Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On this Memorial Day holiday, with the weather finally coming around, we thought we'd take some time on the 21st to talk about good food. We know that Memorial Day traditionally marks the beginning of summer, and what better start to the season than enjoying some barbecue? Back in the fall, around Labor Day, we had a chance to speak with a few chefs from some of the most popular barbecue places throughout Illinois. But first, we caught up with Nuno Ribeiro, who's a huge fan of barbecue. Besides just being a lover of smoked meats, he's also an assistant professor of recreation, sport, and tourism at the U of I. David Rowe also joined us, a board member of the Illinois Barbecue Society. We started by asking Nuno if big cities like Chicago or St. Louis are the only places to find good barbecue in Illinois.
No. There's no doubt there's a very fine barbecue to be found in both Chicago and St. Louis, but you have numerous places throughout the state that have excellent, superlative even barbecue that you can find sometimes in the smallest of places.
And Nuno, when did you first become a fan of barbecue?
Well, I moved to Illinois about 3 years ago. I think I've always been a fan of barbecue, no matter where it is made, provided it's good. I have no prejudice of any kind in regard to barbecue. I like all kinds. And I'm a bit of a foodie, so whenever I hear about a place that might have good food, I'm definitely willing to travel and to make the effort and sometimes get to know the location. I travel a lot for my work. And I had a friend who happens to be from Paxton, my good friend and colleague, Sally Marshall, said, hey, you know, I'm from Paxton. There's a place there opened up that's really, really good. And it was the Humble Hog. And I went there, and I've been a fan ever since. And I've just been expanding the radius of my barbecue forays, which I might say very positive and very delightful successes.
The Humble Hog is going to be Benjamin Grice is going to be joining us later on in the hour. He's the owner and chef of the Humble Hog in Paxton. Paxton's about 30 miles north of Champaign, for folks who are wondering about that. David, what does the Illinois Barbecue Society do?
Well, our focus is primarily on education and supporting the backyard barbecue enthusiast, the barbecue pitmaster, and just generally raising the level of education of barbecue in Illinois. As Nuno said, it's not known as a barbecue state in the past, which is a little bit unfortunate because Illinois actually has a rich history of very strong barbecue presence. Everything from the Weber Grill based in Illinois to Sweet Baby Ray's sauce came out of Illinois, along with a number of other noted barbecue events. So it is unfortunate that people don't think of Illinois as a barbecue state, but it truly is. And the type of barbecue covers a broad range. So it's our goal to hopefully just to educate people, put people either into restaurants if they want to visit different restaurants across the state, or help educate them on how to cook their own barbecue in their backyard.
So let's talk about sauce, David, because that always is the either the contentious, depending, or the defining characteristic oftentimes of barbecue. What kind of sauces do we see across Illinois?
You bring up a good point because there are a group of people that like the dry rubs and sauce never touches their barbecue. Illinois, in general, is a sauce state. People generally put sauce on during the cooking or they add it after. And because of that, the sauces across Illinois, from the best we can estimate, there are about 30 to 50 commercial sauces made just in Illinois. And we know this from running the National Barbecue Sauce Championship here in the United States, which is one of the largest sauce championships that's a standalone event anywhere in the country, where we have upwards of 200 sauces submitted every year that we evaluate and taste and go through, covering everything from the sweet tomato sauces, which is pretty prevalent in Illinois, all the way down to some of the vinegar sauces or the mustard or mayonnaise-based sauces, which aren't as prominent in Illinois but certainly offer a little bit of variety. So the sauces in Illinois typically cover the sweet tomato and the spicy tomato sauces. Again, very similar to the Sweet Baby Ray profile of flavor that a lot of people like. So we've had an opportunity to taste, I've probably tasted upwards of 500 different sauces. So I like to think that I've got some exposure to what those sauces taste like and what makes a good sauce and a bad sauce. And people in Illinois have the unique advantage. Many retailers, including things as Ace Hardware or some of the other small food shops, carry a lot of these local regional sauces on behalf of some of these sauce companies across Illinois. So it's a real opportunity to go into just about any store and pick up one or two unique local barbecue sauces to taste.
That's David Rowe with the Illinois Barbecue Society. We asked you your favorite barbecue, so let's go to a caller too. Before Nuno, I want to hear from, as we've been talking about sauce, what your favorite kind of sauce is. Let's start with our Ted from Springfield has a suggestion for us. Hey, Ted, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Ready to talk about barbecue? What's your favorite place to go to?
I love barbecue. I used to eat barbecue 4 days out of 5 days a week.
Wow.
Every lunch. Yeah. And the reason? They were closed on Monday. And so I couldn't get there.
And where'd you go, Ted?
Clay's Popeye's Barbecue on South Grand, just east of 11th Street, right here in Springfield.
Okay. So Clay's, you said.
Yeah. Clay's everybody knows Popeye's Barbecue. Yeah.
All right.
It's been around for forever in Springfield.
Well, thanks for that. I appreciate that, Ted. Nuno, what about you? Where are some of your favorite places that you like to go? Let's start with, we just heard from Springfield. Where are some other places you like to go in the Champaign area?
We actually have a quasi-barbecue capital of the state, which is in Murfreesboro, Illinois. And I believe they have 4 or 5 barbecue places in the medium-sized or small-sized town, so I like to go there quite a bit. There's also a place in Dwight, Illinois, Cherry Red Roosters, that makes excellent barbecue. And to answer your previous question, what kind of sauce do I like, I'm actually a fan of dry rub. I like to try different sauces. I typically ask to be put on the side, and I'm fairly adventurous, so I'll try just about anything. But I tend to like my barbecue with sauce on the side or without sauce at all.
Right. We could talk about this one for a whole hour. I bet people arguing about whether they want with sauce or no sauce with their barbecue. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We're asking you to call in throughout the state. Tell us where your favorite barbecue places is. Let's go to Sam, who's also on the line from Springfield. Hey, Sam, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thank you. Well, talking about Murfreesboro, I didn't know there were four or five places there, but after viewing the eclipse in Carbondale, I went over to Murfreesboro and stopped in the 17th Street Barbecue, which was packed with people from all over the state who went there after viewing the eclipse, and really great food. So that's I don't know what the other three places are in Murfreesboro, but that place is really good.
Oh, so 17th Street. Thanks for that, Sam. Nuno, you mentioned Pat's, right? And Pat,
right.
Actually, Pat's also going to be joining us later on in the hour as well. Murfreesboro in Southern Illinois. Sam was just mentioning, obviously, they've probably got lots of folks down there for the eclipse. So 17th Street was another one. What are the other two that you, Nuno, that you were
if
thinking
of?
If
my memory serves me correctly, another place is Bandana's Barbecue. There's another mom and pop's place. I want to say Jones. Perhaps it was a local thing. And the last one is escaping me, I'm afraid. The best thing to do really is just to travel there and discover them and test them all by yourself.
Yeah, Nuno, so how do you judge if you're just sort of driving around? So you don't do this. It sounds like you're not doing any social media or web research before you're trying to find a barbecue place. Are you doing this?
Every now and again, I might look at some social media customer reviews, but I tend not to. A lot of it has to do with my professional career and how much I travel inside the state for my job. I'm a tourism professor. And typically it's through word of mouth. You know, someone will tell me, hey, have you considered going to this place or that place? And that's more or less how I discover them.
So you just did you judge it just by exterior appearance? Because I have a judge by exterior appearance and smell, whether or not I think it's good.
I think the smell is very good. I'm not sure exterior appearance is necessary. Sometimes in the most unassuming places you find
No, that's
the best
what I mean.
Barbecue.
Oh, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, you don't want it to look fancy. I feel like if it looks fancy, it might not be as good.
I think
that's
that
my
ultimately
opinion.
It has to do with taste. If it's good barbecue, I think smell is a great indicator. If there's a lot of people hanging out, if you see a lot of people driving off the road to wait for this barbecue, if they run out of barbecue, that's another very good sign. So, yeah, and you have to taste a lot of barbecue, which is quite of a delicious endeavor.
Well, David, I want to ask you your tips on that in a minute for how you go through tasting all of these different sauces. But let's get to a couple other folks with recommendations. Let's go to Dan, who's also on the line from Springfield. Hey, Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Where do you recommend?
I recommend Kags, K-A-G-S, out of Danville. They basically do most of their stuff out of a truck and move it around town. I think they may have a location there, too. I've never been to it. But.
And what kind of style is it? What is it like?
It's they do a lot of the sweeter sauce, but I always get that on the side. I just find it to be very, very flavorful. I mean, it's just good stuff. Prefer the chicken and the ribs, but those are things they do real well.
Been okay.
There for years and years and years and years.
So that's Kags in Danville. Thanks.
Kags.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. That's a good one.
You bet.
So, David, did you say, David, you've tasted 500 maybe or so barbecue sauces in your lifetime?
I'd have to estimate it somewhere near 500 different sauces that I've had an opportunity to taste, yes.
Right. So I'm curious, I mean, it's very interesting nowadays. I feel like we're also seeing a lot of different things, whether we're talking about Black Dog in Champaign or Smoke in Chicago, like lots of different other flavor kind of elements that are being incorporated into sauce. I'm thinking in particular of different like kind of like fruits like cherries and things like that. Is that maybe like a more modern thing or has that been a traditional part of barbecue?
No, I think it's a little bit more modern thing as people have tried to differentiate their product from others. They add in different flavors, trying to explore different flavor profiles. Some of them have been successful. Some of them have, frankly, been a disaster. Some of the sauces, I have to admit, are horrendous and very difficult to even eat.
Right. Really, you shouldn't mess with it too much, right, is basically probably what you're saying.
Well, I think small steps until you serve it to friends and family, see if they like it. And most sauces start out that way, and then they go to the local market or the Sunday farmer's market where they start to bottle it and sell it there. And if it takes off, if people like it, that's a great indicator, but small steps are probably better. Some of the better ones that have won in the past, we have Southern Bells, I think they're out of Pennsylvania, and they had a blueberry sauce that did really well. They won, I believe, this year as a national champion with a peach sauce. So there are some flavor profiles that people really like, as well as the traditional sauces.
And what when we think we're, because we're in Illinois, David, do you think we get, like when you're talking about Sweet Baby Ray's up in Chicago, that's a really sweet, more southern style versus, I wonder what we're seeing across the state, if you can get Memphis, which is more, or Texas or Kansas City, St. Louis. Can you basically get all of those different styles throughout Illinois?
I think that you can. Nuno probably can provide a lot more information on that than I can. But I think that there's a slight variation as you move further south. It does become regional, and so you get the sauces that are not as sweet. I think the sweet sauces probably are much more prevalent to the northern part of the state with the Sweet Baby Ray's area, particularly up here. It came out of Chicago. Sweet Baby Ray's restaurants, there's two of them in the area up here that serve very good food. Interestingly, Dave Raymond, his nephew, Deuce Raymond, has a couple of sauces out right now that he has won some very prevalent national awards on, including this year he won the Illinois People's Taste Award in the barbecue sauce contest, which I'll just mention very briefly. Our contest is a double-blind contest, so the judges have no idea whose sauce they're tasting, and he came out very well. So there's a little bit of family lineage, I think, going on there. But definitely the sauces to the north, a little bit more prevalent on the sweeter side.
Now, you guys are working on putting together a barbecue trail. David, can you tell us about that?
Yes, we've borrowed liberally from the wine industry, both in how we approach the tasting of the sauces, looking at appearance, texture, a savory component, flavor profiles, etc., and also the concept in the food tourism idea of creating a trail or simply a collection of restaurants that people, if they chose to, they could drive from restaurant to restaurant along the trail and explore different barbecue. We've added in restaurants, not only just the most famous ones, but also ones that offer a unique aspect. For example, maybe they're a small out-of-the-way place, they run out of barbecue by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a place you'll have to get there early for lunch and try out some of their barbecue. Or in the Chicago area, even the types of cooking methods. There's an aquarium cooker, which looks like a big fish tank that is kind of unique to the Chicago area, and it takes a very good pit master to run that. It offers a slightly different method of cooking, so the style of cooking can change. So we look for unique aspects to add to this, and we have an outer trail and an inner trail. The outer trail covers the entire state in roughly a loop of about 1,000 miles. The inner trail focuses on the northern Illinois area.
Well, we have to take a break. I want to thank David Rowe for taking some time to join us. He's the board member with the Illinois Barbecue Society. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Nuno Ribeiro and hear from a few of our listeners. Stay tuned to this special Encore Memorial Day barbecue conversation on the 21st. After the break, we'll continue this mouthwatering conversation about sauces, spices, and smokiness here on this special Memorial Day edition of the 21st. Do you have grilling plans of your own this Memorial Day? Show us your best barbecue photos and join our conversation on Twitter. Our username is 21STShow. And stay with us. We'll keep this conversation going just after this short break. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to the 21st. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st on Memorial Day. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're revisiting our conversation about great Illinois barbecue today in honor of the holiday. We just heard from Nuno Ribeiro and David Rowe about some of their favorite things about barbecue in our state. And in a few minutes, we'll hear our conversation with local chefs who really know barbecue and what it's all about. Benjamin Grice is the owner and chef at the Humble Hog in Paxton. That's about 30 miles north of Champaign. Pat Burke is the owner and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering in Murfreesboro in Southern Illinois. We wanted to talk to them about what makes their food unique. We also have some tips for home chefs who want to up their barbecue game. But first, we were lucky enough to get barbecue recommendations from a lot of listeners back in the fall when we first had this conversation. And Kent from Charleston called in to tell us about his favorite place for barbecue in Illinois.
Well, we've got a nice one here in Charleston. It's called Smokey's House Barbecue. And they serve, you know, brisket and pork, and they also have chicken and turkey and sausage and stuff like that. The thing I kind of think a little bit unique is that they also give you a whole bucket with different kinds of sauces, from hot mustard to sweet, there at your table, so you can add more if you want.
Okay, thanks for that, Kat. We've got George from Champaign on the line. Hey, George, what's your comment?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey there.
Hey, I just had a quick comment. I know that we're, you know, in Illinois, the land of the Chicago-style hot dog, and ketchup seems to get a pretty bad rap. But I don't think that a lot of people realize that most of your barbecue sauces, like your main ingredient, is going to be ketchup.
Thanks for that. That's a good point, George. That's George in Champaign. He's right. Even in Illinois, we need to put ketchup in our barbecue sauce, even if we're not going to put it on our hot dogs. Let's actually bring in a couple of chefs from these restaurants. They are here to share their stories and offer some advice. So you can call us as well if you have questions for them. Benjamin Grice is the owner and chef of the Humble Hog in Paxton. That's about 30 miles north of Champaign. Pat Burke is the owner of and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering in Murfreesboro in Southern Illinois. Hey, Ben. Hey, Pat. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Good morning to you.
Hey, Pat, let's start with you. We were just talking to Dave and Rowe about from the Illinois Barbecue Society. He was talking a little bit about some of the competitions they put on. You opened your restaurant in 2002. I understand you've been competing since the late 80s. What first sparked your passion for barbecue?
Well, we started in 1988, and through the competition barbecue, we got off into, like I say, in 2002. I've been doing barbecue since I was a kid on the thing. So, of course, Murfreesboro is now the barbecue capital of Illinois, too.
And can you? We've been talking about sauce. Can you tell us a little bit about the sauce and where you stand on the sauce and where it goes and what your style is?
Yeah, we've got a sweet sauce, and it's whoever's talking to you before. We ketchup is the main part of it, you know, with the ketchup and vinegar, Worcestershire, and all the seasonings and everything. But it's a sweet sauce. It seems like I do a lot of cooking down south, and it's more into hard vinegar base, you know. But up in this part of the country, it seems to get sweeter.
Ben, I understand you were originally working in fine dining in Boston, and then you moved to Paxton about 4 years ago. What brought you there?
Actually, I grew up in Paxton, graduated from Paxton, and then ended up in Arizona going to chef school out there, and then Boston as a chef, and kind of bounced around. And then when we had my wife and I had our first kid on the way, we decided to move back where the grandparents were, and that was a unique experience coming back to a town that I hadn't been a part of in so long. And it was neat to reconnect with everybody and see, you know, what downtown needed and try to, you know, jump in and do my part. You know, it's a small town. It's 4,500 people. So opening our barbecue restaurant downtown was a very big deal for the whole area. And, you know, now we draw people in from all around, so it's been really good for the town and really good for my family. You know, it's definitely a family restaurant. So
that's Benjamin Rice, as we're talking to him, owner and chef of the Humble Hog restaurant in Paxton. Pat Burke is on the line with us as well from Murphy's Bureau. He's owner and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering. Nuno Ribeiro's in our Urbano studio with us. He's teaches in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism at the University of Illinois. Nuno, I wanted to ask you about food tourism. What kind of impact do you think even one good restaurant in a small town can have on the local economy?
It has an enormous and often understated impact, because not only does it drive traffic just for day trippers, which we designate as excursionists, but often it's the catalyst to explore the area. So, for instance, next to Murfreesboro, we have Shawnee National Forest. How many people knew, for instance, that in a small town like Paxton, there's a beautiful Carnegie Library, which is just a little architectural gem? And I think it's not really understood by the public at large the immense economic boom that a very good restaurant, which is a destination in itself, an attraction in itself, does for the local economy. So all of these initiatives, which are commendable, things like barbecue trails, like more publicity for locally owned restaurants, especially in smaller places across the state, they're incredibly beneficial to us.
Let's go to one last recommendation, if we can, as we're talking about that. Heather from Oglesby. Hey, Heather, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, where's your favorite place to go for barbecue?
You know what? It's relatively new. It's in LaSalle, Illinois. It's about 10 minutes away from Starved Rock State Park, and they just serve some really amazing house-made barbecue. All their sauces are house-made. They've got a great variety from sweet to spicy. They've got a bourbon sauce and a Carolina mop sauce that's just amazing.
What's it called, Heather?
Hayes Smokehouse.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Sure. Pat, can I ask you about Murfreesboro? We were just talking, Heather was just talking about Starved Rock. Nuno was just mentioning Shawnee National Forest. What do you think went into, a couple people have mentioned now Murfreesboro being the barbecue capital of Illinois. How do you think that came about, all of these different barbecue places in Murfreesboro?
Well, barbecue started in Murfreesboro at the turn of the century, and it's been pretty popular all along. And then along we came along in competition barbecue and won three world championships, and ended up being two of us here in town, Mike Mills and myself, ended up on a team that did that. And the name got around real good, but it wasn't just us. It this came up from the early 1900s, and so there's been a lot of barbecue places in Murfreesboro, but really noted for it.
And is there a particular, would you say that you all have a particular sauce or style that you think that everybody kind of shares?
Yeah, there are just so many ingredients known to mankind on this sauce and everything. It's the amount that goes into them and what it amounts to. But and then the sweetness of it or the vinegar taste on it, one of the two.
Right. And so is your preference, would you say yours goes closer to more the sweeter than the vinegar?
Yes, it's sweet sauce, and we've got a hint of apple in it. See, this is apple country around Murfreesboro, Illinois. It's called Apple City. And there's a big apple festival here each year in September. And so we got a hint of apple in ours, too.
So, Benjamin, I understand for you guys up in Paxton, you kind of focus a lot also on your brisket, right? How would you describe the sauce that goes along with your brisket?
You bet. Actually, the sauce that goes on the brisket, I kind of took more of an approach of I wanted some tannins in it. Kind of wanted the sauce to just really enhance the meat and not mask it. It is a sweet sauce, kind of like what Pat was saying with his. It's got a lot of flavor. We use the freshest spices we can get, just like Pat or anyone else would want to. One of the differentiators with our sauce, we do use a cold-pressed organic tomato when we make that. So, I like it. It's got enough acidity. It's a pretty well-balanced sauce, but like I said, it doesn't mask the meat. It's really there to enhance it. So, yeah.
Does it make you sad when people put too much sauce on your brisket? It sounds like it would.
You know what? If you want to come in and put ketchup or whatever you want on it, it doesn't affect me emotionally.
But you just think it won't taste as good.
Yeah, well, you know, we want you to enjoy it however you want to enjoy it, bottom line. But we do get people in from, hey, I'm from Texas. I don't want any sauce on it at all. that's fine too. We can put the sauce on the side or not at all, whatever. We do serve our sauce warm. So yeah, you get people that want it drowned in sauce and you get people that want it with no sauce. It's really fine either way.
And Pat, what about, Oh, go ahead, Ben. Go ahead, Benjamin.
I just wanted to say to Pat, if he can hear me, I love his sauce. Pat's restaurant was one of the first barbecue restaurants I went to in Illinois. And I actually got to meet Pat. This was several years ago. I'm sure he doesn't remember. But I just want to say thanks, Pat. You're doing a great job. I really love his place.
I appreciate that, Ben. You know, as Ben said, the meat will stand on its own, you know, and you put a lot of sauce on it, but not at all. We have a lot of people that they do not want any sauce on it. We have a dry rub we call a sweet and spicy, and they put a little of that on it, but some of them don't want the sauce at all, you know, and then others want to drown it with it.
So both of you gentlemen, I do not want to insult your craft and the time that you take and the care that you prepare with your sauce. But I will ask for those of us who are home cooks and home barbecue, people who are thinking about maybe making something for their families this weekend and they don't have your expertise or your tools, what's the best kind of advice you have for home barbecue chefs? Benjamin, can we start with you?
Sure thing. I'd say start online. I mean, there's an endless resource there with anyone can Google. You can get a really simple recipe with, you know, 3 or 4 ingredients, or if you want to go to the grocery store and you know, get 15 ingredients, that's fine too. But, you know, you'll see sauces where you can mix them, you know, just a few ingredients together cold and make yourself a sauce, or you'll have sauces where you got to cook them down a little. There's sauces where you want to put bourbon in them or whatever. Sky's the limit. You could spend your whole career and still not cover it all. So if you're a home cook, pick something that, you know, is more on your level as far as what you have to work with tool-wise, as well as, you know, what your local grocery store will carry. But you don't have to go crazy to make a good sauce. Just like Pat said, you want something that's well-balanced with, you know, enough acidity, so enough vinegar or enough sweet, so you can use molasses or, you know, and ketchup can be the body of it if you want. But they're not hard to make. It's as hard as you want to make it. So, yeah, I'd say check it out online and go from there.
Pat, what about the meat? What kind of meat would you recommend and what kind of advice would you have for folks in terms of barbecuing?
Well, we do Boston butts as far as for our pulled pork. And of course, we do a loin back rib. And then we do the brisket, too, also. And back to that sauce thing just a little bit here. A lot of people will take something like the Kansas City sauce or the Sweet Baby Ray sauce, something that's been known all over, and then they'll modify that, you know. One thing you got to watch on that is when they're finishing off, do not go on the sauce real early. Hold it off to the last 15 or 20 minutes because it has a tendency to burn with you on it then.
That makes a lot of sense. Obviously, you want to be careful about what you put on the grill. And obviously, because I guess you want to be careful about the sugar content there, right? Because that's just going to caramelize
a little bit
too early. Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. That's Pat Burke. He's the owner and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering in Murfreesboro. I want to thank Benjamin Rice as well. He's owner and chef of the Humble Hog Restaurant in Paxton. And Nuno Ribeiro, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism. Sorry, Benjamin Grice. Nuno, any final tips for everybody about if they're traveling around this weekend?
Travel, get off the beaten path, and eat good barbecue.
That sounds good. I think everybody, all of us, Benjamin, Pat, Nuno, you probably made everyone go. Everyone who's listening is now going to have barbecue for lunch because I think you made us all really hungry. Thanks so much, gentlemen. Have a great holiday weekend. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
All right, thank you very much.
We're out of time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have the NPR One app enabled and Alexa, you can also play us from there. Just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. You can also search for us on Facebook. Look for The 21st. And if you like our page, you can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. If you want to contact us, you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, we've got the information at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.